You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal and I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today on the show is Dr. Luke Sheehan, assistant professor of political science at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and non-resident scholar at the Program for Research on Religion and Urban Civil Society at the University of Pennsylvania. Luke, thanks so much for coming on the show. I appreciate you taking time to do this.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So we're talking today about Luke's recent book, right? Recent, really, in the last few months, Why Associations Matter, The Case for First Amendment Pluralism by the University of Kansas Press. So I want to jump into the substance of the book in a minute. But first, can you tell us a little bit about the background? You frame your book around the case Christian Legal Society versus Martinez. Can you just walk us through briefly that case, and then we'll jump into associations.
Yeah, so it's a 2010 case, Christian Legal Society versus Martinez. It took place at Hastings Law School in California, which is a public law school. What happened there is the student group, Christian Legal Society, was a religious student group, and they had membership requirements they had a code that everyone had to abide by and agree to, and is basically what we would recognize as evangelical Christianity, which isn't too surprising. So you believe in Jesus Christ and you abide by certain biblical prescriptions regarding a Christian lifestyle. Pretty standard what you would expect from an evangelical group. They had this in their constitution. The school refused to recognize the student group on that basis. And the school claims they had an all-comers policy. So in order to be a recognized student organization, you had to allow any student to join the group. CLS claimed this is a violation of their First Amendment rights to expressive association and the free exercise of religion and so forth, and freedom of speech. And the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, which is hard to do. And it got there, and the court ruled 5-4 for the university. And why the case is so significant is that the court did not say that this was not a matter of First Amendment rights. It was a matter of internal policy for the university. The court said this is a matter of First Amendment rights. But the free expression of the members of CLS is not hindered by them not being able to impose membership requirements on leadership and voting members. So that is, they said, the free speech, the individual right to free speech of the students is still protected, of course. This isn't going to impinge it. You can say whatever they want. They can express whatever they want. That's not going to stop. The school can't stop them from doing that. And that's the kind of significance of the case, is that there should have been, I think, among others, an associational component that was far more salient to the actual terms of the case than as the free speech component.
Now when I hear, and just if you can give us just a tiny bit more context on this, when I hear 5-4 Supreme Court decision, I think, that Roberts guy is at it again. But that's not right in this case, right? What's the division here?
Yeah, so the division is fairly standard in terms of liberal conservative, kind of the problem is that the dissent written by Justice Alito still spent a lot of time on freedom of expressive association. Now, he wanted to go the other way on that. But the issue is he still didn't develop what you might call a theory of association or rely on association other than the expression of the group. Now, I'm actually a big fan of the free speech jurisprudence of the court. I think that it's done a lot of good. There are problems with it. I quibble over, obviously, but it's done a lot of good. Now, one big problem with it, though, is it swallowed to a great extent the other rights. Now, some First Amendment scholars don't think there's a problem here. Some think there's a big problem. I'm one of the people who thinks there's a big problem. The reason that the scholars think who think there's not a big problem, think that. So they say, well, free speech is a salient right. It's really important to a democratic society that we be free to discuss issues. And if you have something you want to do in terms of religion, just call it free expression. Call it religious expression. You want to do something in terms of association, just call it expressive association. Boom. Your rights are going to be protected. That is not quite true. There's lots of things you do in terms of religious practice, or there's lots of things you do in terms of association that aren't explicitly expressive, and they're certainly not expressive in a way the federal courts have recognized. And I think that's the real problem with this case, and why even the dissent, while they would have gone differently on this particular case, has not provided the federal judiciary with proper guidance in terms of associational rights more broadly. And this case is really dangerous, I think, because the court is looking at an explicit associational issue. Can a group determine its membership? And it says, well, the First Amendment definitely applies here, but freedom of association, what freedom of association? It just will not entertain that it's even a problem. Now, some people have pushed back and said, well, the court, there should have been a, we could have handled this in terms of free exercise of religion. Well, the court dismissed the free exercise claim in a footnote. It just doesn't even deal with it at all. It references the Smith case from the early 90s and says, no, law of general applicability, we don't even have to consider this question. So the threat to association and even religious association is very real in this case.
I said I was just going to do one more background question, but I'm going to hit one more. Does the university setting matter here? I mean, couldn't someone say, yeah, look, you have the right to association, and if this were just a group of people out in the community forming a church or a Masonic temple or whatever, they set up their rules and the court came, you know, some city government came along and said, no, you can't do that. That would be clearly wrong, but that's not any of those things. These are students at a university. They've already associated, and now they have to follow that association's rules, and that association says if you form kind of sub-associations, you must follow these guidelines. Where does that come in?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it does play a role here. So what the court has said regarding student organization forums is that they're an area where the First Amendment rights apply. And that's what makes this case so salient. So when a public university, so the First Amendment rights apply to public universities, not private universities. Right. Public universities can organize themselves internally in terms of colleges and departments. Those aren't First Amendment issues. Professors can't come together and say, we want an English department. It's our First Amendment associational right at a public university. That's internal administration. That's where the decisions get made. But the court has said when it comes to the student organization forum, now we have First Amendment rights in play. Now it's what the court has called a limited public forum. So that is, it's not like a city park, which is a traditional public forum. A limited public forum exists when the government creates the forum. So a public university could decide not to create a student organization forum, decides not to hassle with it. But if it does create one, its hands are tied in terms of some of the rules it can make. If those rules are restricting on First Amendment rights, so if, for example, it creates a student organization forum but refuses to recognize religious groups, or it refuses to fund religious groups on an equal basis with non-religious groups, the court has said these implicate First Amendment rights to religious liberty in those cases. Now, what I'm looking at here is, when groups form in this First Amendment forum, this limited public forum, can the university impose membership requirements on it? Now, the ability to determine your membership of a group, that's kind of the rock bottom associational right. So do you have a First Amendment associational right in this forum? The court has said you have all these other rights, religious liberty rights, free speech rights. It would seem very odd if it says, well, not associational rights. Which is basically what the Martinez court said.
Well, let's dig into that a little bit then. So when I hear your phrase, you know, freedom of association, I certainly think First Amendment, and what I think specifically is assembly, right? That's the phrase that's used there. But you draw a distinction there, and can you talk a little bit about why is there this distinction and why does it matter?
Between the distinction between association and assembly?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the case law is a little sordid when it comes to these issues. So the Assembly Clause is the right to peaceably assemble in the First Amendment. Now, unlike the Speech Clause, the Supreme Court has done very little with the Assembly Clause. A great book came out in 2012 called Liberty's Refuge by John Inazu, a professor at Washington University in St. Louis Law School. An excellent book, really one of the best on the First Amendment in recent years, I would say. He makes the argument that the Assembly Clause, the right of assembly, has historically been very, very significant. So it's in the debates over including the Assembly Clause, there was an argument that the Assembly Clause should not be included because it was so obvious. So to include it was in some sense to demean it. So the argument was, if you're going to exercise your religion freely, if you're going to speak freely, if you're going to have press outlets, all that's going to be free, obviously you assemble to do so. And then one member said, well, it is obvious. In fact, it's as obvious as the right to be able to wear a hat. And that to us is a very seemingly weird example. But to the people hearing that, it was actually an historical reference to William Penn and the right of assembly. William Penn was arrested in 1670 because he tried to assemble Quakers on the street. He was arrested in violation of prohibitions on religious assembly, and he went to the courthouse and he refused to remove his hat. He refused to, that is, recognize the legitimacy of that courthouse. Well, that argument won the day in the first Congress. They recognized that, yes, you could suppress all of these rights, very important rights, if you just didn't let people assemble. You could claim to have religious liberty or whatever and just not let the association take place. The right of assembly shows up in a bunch of the state constitutions. It's key, starting in the 1790s, to the gatherings of Democratic Republicans, dissenters from the kind of Federalist powers that be, such as it was at the time. It plays a very important role in the abolitionist movements, the right of assembly and conventions, and so on. A very important right kind of throughout American history. And the court then incorporates it, along with the other First Amendment rights, in 1937. Has another case in 1945, and then it just begins to be kind of disappear from the case law. And the reason that happens is the court starts to talk about the right of association, which is not in the text of the First Amendment. And it talks about the right of association in terms of the NAACP cases, a series of cases that started in the late 1950s and go into the 60s and beyond. And the court says there's this right of association when you assemble to speak, basically, is how it's formulated. And then in 1984, it gets the official formulation of expressive association. Now, much of that case law is very good. I agree with its outcome. I definitely think the NAACP had a First Amendment right to assemble and to speak and to seek democratic change. All those things the court praises. It kind of recognizes as part of that right. Where I disagree is that the right of assembly is a separate right from the right of speech. That is, you could peaceably assemble and not be speaking, or not be a press outlet, or not be worshiping. That could be its own right. You could be doing some other thing. And as Inazu points out, many of the important groups that we've had in American history, of course, begin as peaceable assemblies. That is, before they speak, you've got to kind of get together and get your ducks in a row. And the court has very much narrowed that right. It recognizes its constitutional importance only when it can be protected under the Speech Clause. Now, I agree that that we should be able to associate, of course, for expressive purposes, but we might associate, and some of our most important associations will be for non-expressive purposes. Religious purposes, to be sure, but also plenty of social purposes, the expressive importance of which might not be recognizable by those outside the association. Now, so the court, the kind of the official doctrine on freedom of association, then, does not link it explicitly to the Assembly Clause. So John Inazu wants us to kind of drop the Assembly Clause, or I'm sorry, the association language, and use the right of assembly, the textual right. But we run into a bit of a PR problem. No one knows what we're talking about when we talk about the right of assembly. We just haven't talked about it kind of in our common parlance. We talk about associations, though. So I'm okay sticking with the language of association, but I want to anchor it clearly into the Assembly Clause and use it as a way to elaborate on what the Assembly Clause means. When we hear it, we think of those school assemblies that were really annoying in grade school and high school, or we think of maybe a protest, which is a form of assembly, but also an exercise of free speech. We don't think of it as the kind of deep exercise of rights that William Penn depended upon, and that that our founders were thinking of when they crafted that provision. So I think we should use the language of association, because we all know what it means, but we should anchor it jurisprudentially in the assembly clause, the textual right of assembly, in the same way we might talk about free expression being protected by the speech clause. It's not in the provision, but we kind of know what it means.
Right, and this is where you draw on the writings of I'm blanking on his first name, Nisbet. Robert Nisbet?
Yes, Robert Nisbet, that's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about him in general, and then specifically what you're using Nisbet for to help build your argument here?
Yeah, so I think I can begin with John Inazu saying this textual right of assembly needs to be unpacked. This needs a jurisprudence. Now, Robert Nisbet, probably the most famous and prominent 20th century sociologist. He wrote 18 books or so on mostly focusing on what associations are. His most famous book is called The Quest for Community, and he says basically persons are communal beings. We need these associations. We cannot thrive outside of them or even survive outside of them. However, he makes the argument that in the modern world, these communities that we've been a part of from time immemorial have become less economically and politically salient. So the state has kind of moved in on their traditional functions. And there have been plenty of benefits of this, increased equality, increased individual liberty. But along with that has come increased alienation, which means rise in suicide rates, rise in kind of despair. People get a meaning in life from their communities. And we can't, if we try to find the meaning of life in our state, it's too abstract. It's too big. We can't find the concrete meaning day to day and those and that just particular association. So he calls for a revival of the communities that are the associations that are important to human life. And he spends a lot of time, literally thousands of pages, unpacking their importance, describing them in very specific terms throughout the course of his career. He died in 1996. So I use his work to help describe what associations are, to try to unpack what the assembly clause might mean. And then if we can describe what these associations are, these assemblies are, we can get to a jurisprudence that will protect them. And so that's how I make use of Robert Nisbet in my book.
And where then do those tie into the CLS v. Martinez case?
Yeah, so the CLS v. Martinez case, I spend dozens of pages kind of parsing the case out, and I see it as kind of the reductio ad absurdum of what I call the First Amendment dichotomy. So that is the court has long treated the First Amendment just in terms of the individual rights, which are certainly there, and the practice of free speech and religious liberty and so on, and the prerogatives of the state, what the state needs. And the court specifically has framed expressive association, the right of expressive association, in terms of the needs of the democratic state and the rights of individuals. So we have a right to expression. One way we express ourselves is certain groups that we join. That's how we communicate it. And so the right of exclusion from certain groups has to do with whether or not they're going to affect the expression of that group. That's important to democratic state because in a democracy, to have a healthy democracy, we need to have discussions. Our citizens need to express themselves. We need to hear each other out, so on. But what about the right of assembly? How does that play into democratic government per se? And it's a few steps removed at best. And plenty of assemblies won't have anything to do with democracy. You'll peaceably assemble, but it just really isn't about democratic governance. In fact, I argue, it's about social governance, about us governing ourselves in ways that won't actually have an effect or only have an indirect effect on democratic governance. It's not about getting someone elected. It's not about expressing ourselves to bring our fellow citizens around to our policy views. It's actually just about the assembly, the association. These can be very mundane matters and very profound matters, but we will form them peaceably and kind of govern ourselves in that social sense rather than in a political sense. So the Martinez Court, it's not there in the jurisprudence, this other aspect, which is why I argue the Assembly Clause just disappears. The court doesn't have a way of thinking about associations that cannot be directly tied into the right of individuals explicitly, or the right or the kind of needs of the state, the needs of the democratic state. And so it just doesn't do anything with this textual provision. And the CLS Martinez case just completely leaves that out. And that's why it can't even recognize perhaps even the expressive needs of the association as a whole. It can only think of the individual members and look at their speech rights, which sure enough are not being censored or suppressed. And it can't even think about associations at all. So that's how that ties in. I saw the CLS v. Martinez case is really showing the court's need for a way to talk about association so it can again bring the assembly clause into play.
So certainly for example, as a Baptist, I, with kind of Baptists through history, have a vested interest in my local church being able to set its own rules for including or excluding people, and when we do that, we're doing that kind of without respect to the health of our community or to our state, but still with the, as Nisbet would say, with the result of, if that Baptist church is doing its job, right, if we are including or excluding people based on the criteria that we think we see in Scripture, that will kind of unintentionally result in a healthy state. Right, that will be a building block in a healthy state. And then when it's, you know, the bowling league and the Rotary Club and all of the other associations doing the same thing, those all contribute to a healthy, stable, free, democratic state. But is it really that's a complicated argument, and it's not at all a constitutional argument. Is it really reasonable to assume that the Supreme Court is going to read all of that into the Assembly Clause? Like how do you get the Supreme Court there?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I've gotten some pushback on that. It's basically saying, well, look, our judges and our justices are just never going to do this. And that's, you know, that could be.
But it makes sense, though, right? Their concern is the democratic state and is the individual rights. Their concern is not is each individual association doing well.
Right, that's right. That's a fair concern. What I would say in response is, we have this provision. I mean, the reason it can look at the free speech clause, which of course does not say, nowhere does it say, you know, we have freedom of speech. Why? Oh, well, you know, democratic state. In fact, there was actually a common good clause that was considered for the First Amendment, and they decided to cut it. And they were worried that government officials would read their own view. That would be an easy way to read your own views in, right? And suppress speech or press or religious groups or free assemblies that you didn't like. And they said, you know, and plenty of them believed in something like the common good. They just were afraid it would be misused. Now, a lot of justices, Justice Breyer, of course, and others will talk about, well, you know, how do I read these clauses? Well, I look for the underlying principle, which is democracy, but it's not in the text. So what I would say is, you look at the Free Assembly Clause and realize it's not giving us you're just ignoring a constitutional provision because your principles are not broad enough. Say, well, I'm looking for the principle of democracy. You might not find it in the Assembly Clause, except in the way you've described. It's very roundabout and indirect, whereas it's much more direct in the Speech Clause and the Press Clauses. We can see a very clear line between democracy, a healthy democracy, and those rights in a way we can't with the Assembly Clause. So what I would say is you must be missing something if you've had to excise in one of your clauses, and you need to take a principled stance on what that clause means. You haven't done so, and you're going to have to start doing it. And that's basically what Inazu says, is let's start bringing cases before the Supreme Court on the Assembly Clause. So that way, sidestep the problematic jurisprudence, the formulations the court has given us and its precedents, which kind of ties its hands a little bit because of stare decisis, and make them consider the Assembly Clause. And as you know, the speech jurisprudence does not appear whole, right? It takes decades for the court to elaborate and unpack and create the boundaries and all of that. And what I think and what Inazu thinks is the court needs to do that with the Assembly Clause, you know, start that half century process of unpacking it. And I try to help the court along by pointing to Nisbet and describing what these assemblies are and their importance, what their contours are, which should help us formulate practical jurisprudential rules on these things.
Right, and again, this is maybe getting a little bit afield, but if So the court says, hey, our concern is, you know, the democratic state. And you say, and I agree with you, you know, no, it should be the exercise of the right for its own sake as something of inherent value. And, you know, we can look at Nisbet and draw on Nisbet for filling in the reasons for that. Yet another concern is what do you do with the judge who comes along and says, yeah, okay, I'll fill in some other reason, but I'm not going to use Nisbet. I'm going to use white racial supremacy, or I'm going to use pick your offensive doctrine of choice, right? How do you draw that line? Once you've said, all right, it's no longer just the government and the individual, which is kind of the easy line to draw. Now we're throwing something else in. Well, what do you do with the person who says, all right, I'm going to throw in what I want to throw in, and what that individual wants is terrible?
Right. Yeah, good. That's a good question. So Nisbet, I think, does a great job of kind of giving us the options of all the sorts of permutations of associations, all the sorts of things that they could appear as. And what are the criteria of a group? And, of course, the way he lays it out, I think, is very helpful in a sense that we could describe literally every single social group by the terms he describes. And I describe them all in chapter two. So going through whether they're personal or what the Germans would call Gesellschaft, which would be more just a kind of singular or kind of utilitarian, or whether a personal aggregate would be something like the family. That's our personal relationships or our close friendships. And then Gesellschaft would be more like the place you work. The only relationship there is you get a paycheck and you do some work, and so on. And everything in between. He has all these different things. We can talk about them in terms of size. We can talk about them in terms of purpose. He does give us we can talk about them in terms of dogma and function. So some formulation of such and such is good, and this group's function is to come up with rituals and practices to bring about that good thing. This could be as banal as playing chess is good. That's your dogma. What's the function of a chess club? Well, to organize in various ways the playing of chess. A religious group says the worship of God is good. The function of the religious group to bring about the worship of God in various ways. And as you know, Baptists do it one way, Presbyterians another, Catholics another, Muslims another, and so on. And they have different dogmas formulated in different ways. Now, what happens if you have a group that says our dogma is the supremacy of the white race and our function is to, bring about the separation of the races and the supremacy of this one race? I mean, that's a great question. And I address that.
And they form a student membership, a student union, yes. Right, at Hastings Law School.
It's Hastings Law School, yes. So you don't have Christian Legal Society. You have
The Klan or whatever. Yeah.
Yes. What I deal with is, and I do deal with this in the book, what happens if there's a student group along this line? So that's a great question. Now, to my knowledge, this has actually not happened in recent memory. So kind of for the record, what does this happen? Let's say this happens. Could a school say, okay, yes, you can have your religious group. You can have your gay rights groups. You can have your evangelical student group. That has its biblical prescriptions. That's one thing. You can have your gay rights group, which has, of course, a different set of requirements. What if it's race? We have an ugly history with race. So we can think about this in several ways. So the way the court's kind of currently thinking about it is you can't make any distinctions in terms of membership, or the university can impose that on you. Now, we could say you can make distinctions in basis of membership, but not on the basis of status. This would be things like sex or sexual orientation, or maybe just sex. I mean, you could define status in different ways. Or we could say you can make distinctions on the basis of sex. So that means you can have fraternities and sororities, and on sexual orientation. So it means that you get to have your evangelical student group as well as your gay rights group, which might some permutations of that might be just for what we would call sexual minorities today or something like that. And not even allies. Right. You might have a more narrow group. What about race, though? So we could say, well, but not race. That's just we have too ugly of a history. Let's not do that. So now each of these distinctions is arguably, the critics would argue, arbitrary at some point. why race? I mean, if we're going to say it's too damaging to have racially exclusive groups, then why can't we, then why is it not damaging to have groups that discriminate on the basis of sex and sexual orientation? And if that's damaging, you know, to the individuals excluded, why is it even possible to have exclusion on other bases? Look, I guess the Martinez court was right. We should have, it's okay to get rid of all exclusion. And that's a good argument. Now, I make the distinction between race and sex and sexual orientation. And it's a distinction that there is plenty of pushback that you can make against me for that. For the reasons, one reason I just stated, well, why not? You know, if race is so bad to exclude, you know, why can we exclude on other bases? The reasons I give are, which will not satisfy everyone, are that kind of race is unique in our history. And so there might be reasons the states could intervene in the student organizational context to force inclusion on the basis of race, given the role that higher education plays in our educational system and therefore in our economic system. So this is somewhat of what the court touches on when it's permitted the denial of tax exemption status to religious religious universities that have racial policies. And the reason the court has said is basically, well, it's higher education is so important in economic advancement, we could end up with a sort of racial class system if we permit this in higher education. So I say, well, using that analogy that the court has allowed the denial of tax exemption status to educational institutions, maybe that will that could be allowed then as an exemption in the student organizational context. Now, as I acknowledge in the book, you can push back on me and say, well, wait a second, the student organizations, that's not the same as getting into the university at all, right? You can still get your education just because some group of nine people don't let you join. That's not the same. It's not going to get you an education. And that's a good point. I kind of say, well, you know, on balance, I think this would be an acceptable kind of neutral area that we can kind of meet on. This is something a concession I think we can make on freedom of association in this context. So you can push back at me though on that. I acknowledge that that counter argument. I also acknowledge the counter argument. I think it's one that academics should be willing to acknowledge. Is, you know, I don't. Kind of the racial groups are to me like the worst ones, right? I think white supremacy is kind of the biggest of the social evils you can have, things I disagree with. Right. That's the one I think is really the worst. It's one that has kind of the ugliest history.
Really a brave, controversial stand you're taking.
Yeah, that's right. I am just a hero. I'm like that Babylon Bee hero that I condemned, you know.
Right.
It's a great Babylon Bee article where it says, hero, man condemns Nazis on the internet. And I'm a hero academic. I condemn racial supremacy in my book, an academic book. Wow. But I acknowledge that could be. So I'm basically reading in, here's the groups I really don't like. Oh, by the way, there's an exception on associations for them. Oh, imagine that. The one group I don't like and the one group that would be the most controversial to defend. Lo and behold, that's where I make my concession. And that's a counter. I acknowledge that. Like, let's be careful here. I'm making a concession on precisely the thing that's, as you just pointed out, fewest people will push back on me on, and is the one I happen to dislike the most. Well, that should be suspect to my readers. And so that's where that's kind of how I try to work out and give us some guidelines of how we can think through, what exceptions we want to make. Now, interestingly enough, I think it was the Ninth Circuit had a case in 2006 where it actually applies the Bob Jones line of jurisprudence. So that is the ones where the court took tax exemption away from universities with racial policies. And it said that only applies to African Americans, actually. So it permitted, right. So what you can't do is have a school or a university that has policies that will exclude African Americans. But you can have a policy that only includes, in this case, Native Hawaiians. So you can have one that's it's kind of about racial inclusion rather than just exclusion, which is kind of an interesting twist on that jurisprudence. And that was just a circuit court case. But the federal courts have been very narrow on that exception. And I talk about that in the book. This is kind of a very sordid area. And so I'm making kind of that concession on there. And as you pointed out, there's lots of room to push back on me on both sides. I should make more concessions or I should make fewer. You can argue both ways. Yeah, I kind of, one thing is a lot of the arguments about when we shut down associations, when we permit the state to intrude, has to do with whether or not that group has become a gatekeeper in some way, a gatekeeper to political office or a gatekeeper to economic advancement. So that is, it's operating in this kind of pseudo government role. Right. So it's you can think of it, if Christian Legal Society had somehow become the gatekeeper of the law review. And so you just have to be a member of CLS to be a member of the law review. Well, suddenly only evangelical Christians can run the law review. Needless to say, that was not the case. But if it were the case, you could see where like the state intervenes and says, I'm sorry, you've become a gatekeeper. You're carrying out a government function of sorts. You can see where that would push back. Now, are these racial groups we have around, is that what they're doing? If we did have a white supremacist group on campus, are they going to be the gatekeepers to anything? I don't think so. If that happens, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But right. That's a very good pushback, is that this segment of our society no longer has social and political power. So their associations, you know, and when this is in terms of tax exemptions and stuff, they're just not they're not movers and shakers. So you take the Bob Jones case. Bob Jones University is a fundamentalist school that it's not Harvard. You know, it's not any. So to say, like, if Harvard was doing this to this, you know, to this day, had those exclusive policies, you could see where, yeah, you know, maybe the government should intervene in these private groups. But it just, they all abandoned those on their own. As the social changes took place, it's just not the case we're in. So that's a very good pushback against me, is like, I'm kind of willing to limit these groups, at least in this one context, the educational context. But they, you know, why? They're not the gatekeepers. They're not going to be. What's the argument here? And that's a good pushback.
And I think a key word there in the First Amendment is that peaceable, right? A peaceable assembly, as long as you're not, you know, using your group to plot to terrorize others, or and you can get into some difficult questions about, well, is the mere existence of the group an act of, you know, harm to other individuals? I think that's a fair and legitimate question to ask. But historically, at least, and you can certainly speak more to this than I can. My understanding is things like the original federal government shutdown of the Ku Klux Klan kind of hinged on that peaceable word, right? The Klan wasn't there to hold potlucks and, you know, community barbecues. It was there to terrorize freed slaves.
That's exactly right.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, exactly right. The Ku Klux Klan, they were there to break the law. Literally, that's why they showed up, was to damage property and possibly even kill somebody. That was literally the point. And the exceptions to the First Amendment that have been drawn up are, you know, true threats. You don't have free speech when it's a true threat. You can't actually threaten to kill somebody. And the Klan was literally there to threaten to kill people, like, or to actually kill them. I mean,
right.
So that's exactly right. That their entire suppression of the Klan hinged on that. They are literally here to kill and suppress people. So that's, or to threaten people with bodily harm and to destroy their property. That's literally the point of them showing up. So that's exactly right. And of course, I don't think anyone wants to get rid of that standard. I don't think anyone does, other than the Klan itself. But so we could permit the white supremacist groups. So the argument against me is, well, let's permit them unless they start threatening people. Then yes, of course, we should shut them down. And then the second question you asked, you kind of brought up their second issue there, is, well, maybe the mere presence is a threat. And it's something to ask and to think about, especially, say, given the history of the Klan.
Sure.
You really have a Klan group that isn't associated with that history. That's a very good question. Whether or not it's just not threatening because it's been threatening for a century and a half. It does, you know, is it just threatening by its very presence? That's what it's always done. So that these are very kind of good pushbacks against the concessions I'm making on when the government can intervene.
I'd intended to kind of end with the question on race, but we've hit that.
Yes.
So anything you'd like to add about freedom of association? What should if someone's going to walk away from this, not as an attorney or a Supreme Court judge, what do you want kind of the average reader to walk away with?
Yeah, that's good. That's a good question. There's two things. Now, we were just talking about race, and that's the most controversial, right? And I say that in the book, and I think I'm right on that. But the thing to remember is that the right of association, in whatever form it took, when it was earlier called the right of assembly, or when it's today we like to call it the right of association, what I'm criticizing, when the court wants to call it expressive association, this right has been very, very important for two reasons. All of the minority groups that we like, so that is the NAACP, so racial minorities, the abolitionist movement, when it was a minority position, they found their refuge in the right of assembly and the right, what I'm calling the right of association. They were able to form that against the majoritarian norms of a democratic society. So the protection for those groups, the ones we like, the ones we're glad historically that have prevailed, were allowed to prevail because they could form these groups. Now, the kind of downside of that is they prevail. Their norms become the majoritarian norms. And then the minority groups that now are going to claim those protections are the ones that we dislike, the white supremacists and so on. This is kind of the downside. So, but it's important to keep that in mind. The Quakers, William Penn would have been much better off if he and his Quakers could have just had their meetings. And that was something our founders were very aware of, is that we need to let William Penn and his likes have their meetings, and so on. And that's so the kind of first thing to remember is that the minority groups that we're worried about, what were we just talking about with the race? We're kind of afraid of the groups that will be suppressed, perhaps, by the presence of one of these bad groups. They're the ones that have benefited the most, far and away, from the right of assembly and the right of association. The second thing to remember is kind of a personal advice, I'm trying to unpack the saliency of the assembly clause. And what you discover there when you study it is just how important these associations are to all of us, our personal associations, in terms of our psychological, emotional, spiritual health. The Baptists are very keen on this point, actually. Your inclusion in your local Baptist church, your local community, that's very important to you as a believer. It's also very important to you as a person. A person who's actually communal in your leanings, that you need your that psychological support. Human beings just need it. And we're actually making some discoveries in terms of our neurobiology and why this is actually just ingrained in us. So the kind of the second thing to take away from this is how important these are, the right this is to have these groups, but how important they are personally to all of us, that we want to integrate ourselves in these associations and remember the freedom that we need to be able to have them. This is very important to just our well-being. The founders did not write idly when they talked about the right of peaceful association. They intuited, I think, correctly just how integral this would be to human life.
Well, I think that's probably a good place for us to close out. I assume since you've got now one book on an obscure kind of portion of the First Amendment, your next one will be on petition.
Oh, yes. So the petition clause is a very good book that just came out a couple years ago on the right of petition. I am kind of I'm working on a book right now on what I call the plural constitutional community. So drawing up Nisbet, he talks about the plural community, right. Is kind of extrapolating that to what that would look like in our constitutional system, and kind of what sort of values and changing of perspectives we bring to it if we think in terms of a plural constitutional community. So the First Amendment pluralism, of course, fits into that, but kind of extrapolating out to the larger structures that we have. But I am noodling a book on the First Amendment more broadly, and because the petition clause isn't brought up at all, and it's actually an ancient right. It goes all the way back in English law to the 10th century is when it starts being talked about. It's very ancient, and it's very, very important in terms of the role played in even American society for a long time. John Quincy Adams, when he kind of attacks the gag rule, a big part of it was not actually free speech. It was petitions. Like, these people are bringing petitions. Our job is to address them. Like, literally, that's our job. And the right of petition, too, has a fascinating history. If you brought a right of, as everyone knows, you could be censored for practice of free speech and free press for a long time. You know, there's the idea of seditious libel. The idea of seditious libel did not apply to petitions, interestingly enough. So the right of petition, in fact, King James II gets himself ousted basically for violating the right of petition. It was just, it was considered so central to the English minds that when he tries to arrest the seven bishops for sending him a petition, it's just is beyond the pale for the English people. And so in our own history, there's, when petitions are brought by certain minority groups, say freed slaves in the antebellum period, they're taken very, very seriously. So that's not like, you know, freed slaves who didn't have hardly any rights in the antebellum South brought a petition to I forget which state it was in. I think it was North Carolina. They brought the petition. And so you have all these slave owners, right, in the assembly who gets a petition from these freed slaves about a tax on black women. So there was this tax on black women, but not white women, which of course meant there were more taxes on black families than white families. And they bring this, the freed slaves bring this petition, and they say, you know, this is unfair. And the assembly changes the law. So it takes the petition, takes it very seriously, and addresses it. It's just an amazing, amazing thing. But the right of petition, yeah, super important. And one that's been really been lost in our current jurisprudence.
That's, it sounds like that should be a book at some point too then.
Yes.
I mean, to be fair, Obama did bring it back with the online petition, which was quickly used to try to get Justin Bieber deported, if you remember.
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. That'll probably get edited out. Luke, thanks so much for taking time to come on the show. I appreciate this, and I appreciate the book, and I'll encourage you listeners to go and pick up Why Associations Matter, The Case for First Amendment Pluralism. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high